Hello! Welcome to the Healthy Habits, Happy Home podcast hosted by the Guelph Family Health Study.
If you're interested in the most recent research and helpful tips for healthy, balanced living for you and your family, then this podcast is for you. In each episode, we will bring you topics that are important to your growing family and guests who will share their expertise and experience with you.
Our quick tips will help your family build healthy habits for a happy home. Welcome back to the Healthy Habits, Happy Homes podcast. I'm Marcy Ann.
And I'm Tamara.
And today, we're excited to have Timothy Caulfield join us. Timothy is a professor in the Faculty of Law in the School of Public Health and research director of the Health Law Institute at the University of Alberta. He was the Canada Research Chair in Health Law and Policy for over 20 years, from 2002 to 2023. His interdisciplinary research on topics like stem cells, genetic research ethics, and public representations of science and public health policy has allowed him to publish almost 400 academic articles. He has won numerous academic, science communication, and writing awards and is a member of the Order Canada and a fellow of the Royal Society of Canada, the Canadian Academy of Health Sciences, and the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry. He contributes frequently to the popular press and is the author of two national bestsellers. First one is The Cure for Everything, Untangling the Twisted Messages About Health, Fitness, and Happiness, published in 2012, and Is Gwyneth Paltrow Wrong About Everything, When Celebrity Culture and Science Clash, published in 2015. His most recent book is Relax, Damn It, A User's Guide to the Age of Anxiety. Caulfield is also the co-founder of the Science Engagement Initiative, #ScienceFirst, and was the host and co-producer of the award-winning documentary TV show, A User's Guide to Cheating Death, which has been shown in over 60 countries, including streaming on Netflix in North America. He has a combined following of over 100,000 on Instagram and Twitter. You can find him on both these platforms at CaulfieldTim. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us, Timothy.
Oh, thanks so much for having me on. I'm really looking forward to this conversation.
Same. To get us started, can you tell us a bit about yourself, your current role, and how your education and experiences led you to where you are now?
Sure. So my main job is still professor. I'm a researcher at the University of Alberta. And, you know, I continue to do research with an amazing, amazing interdisciplinary team exploring really public representations of health and science. It's something I'm really passionate about. And so we use a bunch of different methodological methods to do that. And, you know, I don't have the methodological chops to do it. So I'm lucky that I get to collaborate with amazing scholars all across Canada to do that. And, you know, I really started as more of a traditional law professor, you know, decades ago, I'm embarrassed to say. But very, very, very quickly, I transitioned into really more of an interdisciplinary scholar. And, you know, I've loved it. I haven't turned back from there. I've worked on big research teams exploring everything from genomics to stem cells to the microbiome to precision medicine. But really, really, I'd say over the last, you know, 15 years, my passion has been how science and health and public health is represented in the public sphere, including tackling, you know, misinformation, health misinformation, which has really been my focus lately.
That's amazing. Yeah, we're so excited to have you on. Obviously, you come with a wealth of knowledge and expertise. And so let's jump right into this misinformation conversation. So your work often challenges the myths and misconceptions surrounding topics like nutrition, fitness, and aging. What are some common misconceptions in these areas that you believe have the potential to significantly impact public health? And how can individuals and families navigate through the noise to make informed decisions?
Oh my God. You know, where do I start? You guys buckle up.
Here we go.
Yes.
You know, first of all, right off the top, and I know I don't have to convince you guys of this, but the spread of misinformation, And I use that term, you know, sort of as a blanket term that includes, you know, disinformation, you know, fake news, you know, bad representations of science. So let's use that as an umbrella term. But misinformation, it's killing people now. I mean, it's killing people. Very recently, it was recognized as the single biggest threat to humanity. And right now, wow. So you think about. You think about climate change, and you think about the conflicts that are happening around the world. Misinformation was picked as number one, and there's been, you know, surveys, international surveys that have been done. There was one done, a large one, almost 20,000 respondents, and they rated misinformation, the spread of misinformation, right up there with climate change as a threat to humanity. I could go on and on and on. This is a real. It really one of the defining issues of our time. And to just give you one more example, in the United States, the head of the FDA really over the last 18 months has consistently said that he believes the spread of health misinformation has contributed to the decline in life expectancy in the United States, which you guys probably know is at a 25-year low, right? So this is where we're at. So this question is a big one. It's an important one. So, you know, what are some of the themes out there? Obviously vaccination, right? We know that the spread of misinformation is resulting in more hesitancy. And in many, I think it's really important off the top to say, in many jurisdictions, it's not just misinformation or vaccination hesitancy, right? It's access. It could be even things like, you know, needle fear. It could be the inequitable distribution of vaccines. All of those things really, really matter, right? So the infrastructure, et cetera, that really matters. But in most of the OECD countries, the spread of misinformation is core, right? It's absolutely core to this. And so, as I said, it's killing people. It's killing people. Maybe can circle back to that, because you often hear people say, well, we've lost trust in institutions, but a lot of that distrust has been created by those spreading misinformation. But let's talk more about, you know, in the area of healthy lifestyles and wellness and nutrition. I'm gonna cheat a little bit and talk big themes as opposed to particular things. One of the things that I think is happening now is the use of fear-mongering, right? And we definitely see that with food. We see that with, you know, toxins, and I'm putting that in air quotes, as you guys know. We definitely see that, and I think that leads to a lot of misconceptions about, you know, that you guys know this better than I do, what a healthy lifestyle, what a healthy diet actually looks like. We also see, I think, the increasing noise in the health and wellness space. And what do I mean by that? Well, it's just such a chaotic information environment now, often filled with fear mongering about things like what causes cancer. And we know research, you know, pretty consistently tells us that can cause people to disengage, to not listen to experts, and create the belief that a healthy lifestyle is much more complicated and more expensive than it needs to be. And you guys know this well. What is a healthy lifestyle? You know, it's what works for you. You know, a healthy lifestyle, the best diet, let's pick that. Best diet is a diet that's healthy, sustainable, and works for you, right? There's really no magic, but the information ecosystem, right? They don't want that to be the conclusion. It has to be complicated. It has to require new products. It often is infused with fear. And research, I think, consistently tells us it does, you know, that does real harm.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that is, I think what you said, that it's like the single biggest threat to humanity, like that really puts it into perspective, just how prevalent all this stuff is. Like, we all come across it in our day-to-day lives all the time, right? And it is making it just so much harder to even digest, like even talking about a healthy diet. Like, you know, it's like, well, what is a healthy diet? Like, we forget like about those like core kind of basic fundamentals, like how you kind of broke it down, you know. It's a healthy diet. It's what works for you. It's what's accessible to us, like all those things. But it just gets so complicated so quickly. And I kind of wanted to circle back to what you were saying about, you know, the distrust in all of this, because I am a bit curious. You know, obviously, I think that the misinformation comes from a lot of different sources. So I was wondering if you could just speak to a bit about where this misinformation is coming from and where is it found?
Yeah, unfortunately, it's everywhere now. it's in the ether now. Look, there's no doubt social media has changed. You know this, right? Social media has changed everything. Yeah. You know, I've been working in this space for decades, and I started researching how does popular culture represent, you know, diet and science and exercise and public health measures. How is that represented in newspapers and in magazines? Do magazines even exist anymore? I don't know, right? And so now, you know, we've really, of course, it's become about social media. And, you know, that's an obvious response, but it is so, so true. And studies show this again and again and again. So first of all, on social media platforms, they're just filled with misinformation, right? So that's the first obvious point. There's been studies that have shown like TikTok has as much as 20% of the content is misinformation. And for some topics like vaccines, it's as high as 50%. So just the degree to which social media platforms have misinformation on them is problematic. Secondly, social media platforms, of course, their algorithms play to our fears. That word again, they plays, yeah, to our cognitive biases. That's a problem. And these platforms also help to create echo chambers. You know, on the good side, they can also help to create communities that people can feel part of. And, you know, we shouldn't forget the plus side of this equation, right? It can be empowering, right? Where maybe you feel alone and you feel like there aren't people that, you know, look like you, are the same size and shape as you. And you can find those, you know, warm communities on social media. That's a good thing. But, mm-hmm, but we also know social media can create these echo chambers that again play to our cognitive biases. And the other thing, of course, what's happening now, and I think this is a trend that's really happened really even over the last couple of years, is the degree to which these echo chambers are about ideology. And unfortunately, that is a real problem, because the more misinformation becomes about ideology, the more difficult it is to debunk it, to change people's minds, because it becomes part of who they are, right? It becomes part of their community, and it becomes part of their personal identity. And so that part of the story is more important than the facts, right? You believe something because that's what your community believes. And we're starting to see that occur more frequently, I think. And by the way, we all live in echo chambers. It may feel like I'm pointing at certain communities. No, we all live in echo chambers, and we need to remind ourselves of that.
That's so true. I know we'll get to it later, but, you know, you just speaking about the spread of information, the prevalence of it, the, you know, the dangers that can come from it. It's just sad how our fears are played on a lot of the times. And then I'm just thinking of like myself, and I have younger siblings. Just, I can't imagine now growing up where you have social media and it's just in your face so much more than it was when I was growing up. So it's just, you know, it really is something that we really need to, mm-hmm, take seriously.
For sure. And I'm assuming you're quite young. And so even hearing that from you, you know, I have four kids, and there's a difference between my youngest and my eldest, right? Mm-hmm. In their exposure to social media. And, you know, studies, you know, one question I'm often asked, you know, is who's most susceptible to misinformation? Look, we're all susceptible to misinformation. Yeah. I've fallen for it. You've fallen for it. We've all fallen for it. But yeah, there are individuals that are more susceptible. But there has been very recently interesting research showing that, you know, the younger demographic, maybe surprisingly, because you would think that they would be more tech savvy, more maybe a little more skeptical, they are often more likely to fall for misinformation. And it's not because, mm-hmm, that younger demographic is not as smart, you know, that they don't necessarily have the cognitive tools. It's because of exposure, right? They're just constantly bombarded. Their information, yeah, environment, mm-hmm, is so chaotic that it can become very difficult, yeah, you know, to get the truth, you know, from the noise, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I mean, we've all fallen into those rabbit holes, right? On like social media and Instagram and TikTok. And then, you know, mm-hmm, like you mentioned with the algorithms, and then they know, and then you keep seeing this stuff. And I think at a certain point, for sure, it's just so hard to distinguish between what is, you know, what is evidence-based and what isn't, especially once, you know, you as an influencer attains a certain following, it's like, oh, well, I like them, so I trust what they say, you know, even if it's not necessarily evidence-based. Yeah. So it gets very tricky. That's very interesting.
You're so right about that. And, you know, the thing about social media, is that they're putting this content in front of you so incredibly quickly. And this is something we can come back to at the end, that research has, you know, again, consistently shown that that is an important factor in the embrace of misinformation. If, you know, if you're exposed to something enough, it gets a truthiness to it, right? Pretty consistently. Yeah. It's one of those cognitive biases, right? If you see something enough, it starts to feel true. And that's why I often say, you know, we've got to debunk and we've got to pre-bunk even the stuff that seems absurd, you know, like don't drink urine. Seriously, don't drink your own urine. Right? And that seems absurd. But if you see enough on social media, and if you see, you know, some influencers say it, all of a sudden it feels like maybe there's something to it, right? So yeah, it's a good reminder to debunk even the absurd stuff, because social media can be filled with that noise.
That is so, so true. Thank you for sharing those points. And one of your projects, The Science of Pop Culture, examines the portrayal of science and health in entertainment media. Can you share some insights into how these portrayals influence public perceptions and attitudes towards science? And what role do entertainment industry stakeholders and even social media networks play in promoting accurate representations of scientific concepts?
Yeah, I am absolutely fascinated in the role of pop culture. And it's interesting, when I first started working in that sphere, you know, really it was years ago. And I remember colleagues would say, oh, that sounds like a fun project. And I think people kind of thought it was frivolous and maybe not really that important. You know, maybe it's fun and it has a niche application. They're not saying that anymore. You know, there's full recognition that, you know, pop culture has a massive impact. And by the way, not just in the context of you know, healthy behaviors and public health initiatives, but even in the context of how we think of science more broadly. You know, think about the role of pop culture framing how we thought about human cloning, right? We have, you know, I worked a lot in that space. So that's like, you know, the early aughts. We had Dolly and we had the Raelians, which was a sex cult from Montreal that claimed that they cloned the first human. All of this stuff had an impact on how the public thought about cloning. But not just the public, politicians too. And I really believe that's one of the reasons that we ended up banning human cloning was more as a result of the pop culture portrayals of cloning, you know, in movies, you know, in science fiction books, than the reality of human cloning, which, you know, somatic cell nuclear transfer might have been a useful scientific method. And I think there's empirical evidence to back up that speculation. You can also think about something like genetic discrimination. You can't talk about genetic discrimination without the movie Gattaca coming up. I don't know if you guys saw Gattaca, but it's always referenced, right? It's like this touchstone regarding what genetic discrimination would look like in the future if we didn't impose laws. And I don't think that's the best way, the most rational and most sort of thoughtful way of creating laws. But we also know that pop culture can have a dramatic impact on human behavior. You know, suicide, smoking, certainly diets, extreme diets. But one of my favorite examples is the Jolie effect. Have you guys heard of that?
No.
So the Jolie effect is something that even our team researched, in fact. So Angelina Jolie, I'm sure you know who she is.
Yes.
And this is, she's married to Brad at this time. So cast your memory back to, you know, 2013, 2014, 2015, that zone. Angelina Jolie writes two very thoughtful op-eds in the New York Times. They were short, they weren't sensationalistic, and they were basically just describing her decision to get genetic testing to find out if she had the BRCA1, BRCA2 gene, right? Predisposing her to cancer. Mm-hmm. And her decision to get a mastectomy, prophylactic mastectomy and oophorectomy. Those two op-eds resulted in the Jolie effect. Basically, this spike in uptake of both genetic testing and prophylactic surgery, which these are not, you know, frivolous decisions, right? These are pretty big decisions. Yeah. And that was a robust finding, right? Now, we can have an interesting debate whether that was good or bad, right? Did that lead to iatrogenic injury? Did all those individuals really need to get genetic testing? Did it create more anxiety? Lots of interesting conversations we can have around that. Yeah. But there's no doubt that the Jolie effect is real. And by the way, it was quite sustained. It wasn't a short-lived phenomenon. Another really, really good example, and one that I think is more clearly in the negative column, is Jenny McCarthy, right? Jenny McCarthy and the ridiculous idea, the completely fraudulent, often proved to be wrong idea that vaccines cause autism. Of course, that flows from the fraudulent study in Lancet in 1998 by Andrew Wakefield. Got to emphasize it again and again. Fraudulent study has been shown to be fraudulent. He has been shown to be a fraud. He's been stripped of his license. Despite all of that, right, Jenny McCarthy goes on Larry King, talks about how her son has autism, and she attributes it to vaccination. And on that Larry King show, there's Jenny McCarthy, and I think there was two or three, you know, experts who have spent their entire life studying vaccines. You know, these are experts. Who do we remember? Yeah. Like here, I study this and I can't even remember who the experts were. And I remember Jenny McCarthy was there. And oh my gosh, she completely normalized this incredibly harmful myth. And we remember Jenny McCarthy because not only because, you know, she's saying these dramatic things and she's a celebrity, but she's a mom telling a story. And even as she's saying it, I think there's, you know, the banner under her on CNN on the TV says autism warrior, right? So she's being, you know, valorized for basically spreading lies. So whenever someone says, oh, does pop culture have an impact on health? Holy cow. Yes, it does. And then you enter into the social media era, and we've just supercharged everything that I just mentioned. And it's only going to get more intense in the future.
Oh, absolutely.
Thanks for sharing all that. Like the thing that keeps running through my mind is like, wow, like you really have to be careful what you say. You know, it's something that my parents always tried to instill in me, just in general, but especially if you're on a platform where, you know, thousands or millions of people are watching you or viewing your content, you know, you want to make sure you're actually giving important information, because like you pointed out, there's some positives. Like I'm originally from the States, and I know that there were some shows that I watched specifically that had like a majority African-American cast that was trying to promote like get a physical and, or, you know, just take better care of yourself in certain aspects where we know like our communities, there's a stigma there. So, you know, that was positive. But then there's other things like, you know, the Jenna McCarthy interview or these extreme diets, things like that. And it's just, you know, there's very serious negative consequences that could come from spreading misinformation that's preventable. And that's the sad part.
I agree with everything you've said. it's so true. and we should remember about the positives, right? Because it is easy to dump on a technology and be enraged at the impact it's having on culture, but it's not going away. Right. It is not going away. We're not going to wave a wand, and there's not going to be, you know, social media and the internet and search engines are going to disappear, nor would we want them to. Right. So it is important to reflect on the positive. You know, we've done research on, for example, on TikTok, on its impact and how TikTok represents transplantation in the organ space and donation in the organ space. Right. Organ donation. And we kind of thought it would be. Our hypothesis when we first went in, there was going to be a lot of misrepresentations and sensationalistic content, and it was kind of doing harm to the area. And we found the opposite. We found it to be quite positive, you know, a place where people can talk about donation, where it raises awareness about donation and people talked about their transplantation journeys. And so, yeah, it was very, very positive. And then if you also think about it in the context of body positivity, I think for a while, you know, I think social media was, you know, terrible. You know, the Fitspiration, is that how you say it? Mm-hmm. That whole movement, you know, just ridiculous.
Yeah.
But I do think we started, I'm curious if you guys agree with me, we started to see more body positivity. It's still terrible, by the way. I don't want to make it sound like it's the problem has gone away. But I do think we're starting to see a breadth of representations of individuals, you know, exercising and living a healthy lifestyle. And I think that's good too.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think a big part of it too is like when you start engaging with some of that positive content too, then you start seeing that more as well. And I think it's nice because there are, especially in the context of body positivity, like I can think of a few influencers to name off even, and it's just nice seeing them focus on movement just for pleasure, like just for joy, like moving in a way that makes you feel good versus like the Fitspiration, you must move your body and do this and work out and eat, you know, very minimally, right? Like all those kind of strict ideals. So it's nice to see a bit more of that.
Yeah, and if you don't do that, you know, it's sort of like shame on you and you're lazy, and, you know, and working out like a maniac and not eating except for one meal a day is like noble and virtuous, right? You know, that, all that messaging is just terrible.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, obviously it's like a multi-billion-dollar industry too, right? So it's, there's plenty of that messaging still out there as well, but it is nice to see a bit more of the positive stuff.
Yeah, I agree. And what's interesting is how can we somehow heighten that, right? That content, how can we incentivize that content? Cause the algorithms are just so, you know, they're not our friends.
They really aren't. The algorithms, they work hard, those algorithms, and they're good at it.
They really, really do. And then those with the biggest platforms, and I'm thinking like of the Joe Rogans of the world, I wish, you know, you said that earlier. I wish they would more internalize that idea that they have a responsibility. You know, I know they don't view it that way, but you know, what is he's got like 100 million followers or something. And, you know, and it's just like, he marches through his studio just a sea of misinformation mongers that he must know. He must know are not science informed or are fringe in a not a good way. I'm not saying there aren't controversial views out there that need to be heard. You know, they're disproven ideas that we know are harmful. But I think he must know this, right? And I think what happens is the information ecosystem is incentivized to bring on those voices because he knows it's going to create rage, which creates, you know, clicks and views and more people talking about him. And that's what the information economy wants, right? So somehow we have got to figure out how we can tweak the machine to incentivize, you know, just science-informed content.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it just continues to drive that too, right? Like you get stuck in that trap. And I'm curious actually, like what responsibility do you think influencers, and I use this term very like loosely, right? But anybody with a following on social media and stuff, like what do you think their role is in sharing and promoting like evidence-based information?
Well, I do think they have that responsibility. And you know, I have to be careful because I can't presume what their motives are. Right. I think that they probably falls on a continuum where there are some individuals that, you know that they're lying and they're lying because they have a particular agenda that they want to put forward. And then there are some that maybe are, you know, a little bit further down that misinformation continuum where they maybe suspect this isn't true, but they like to, I put Gwyneth Paltrow in this camp, right? Where she must have a good idea that this stuff is nonsense, but she has a brand to build, right? She has a brand to build.
Yeah.
And then you go further down that big brand, and then you go further down that continuum and you have people that I think they probably believe it, right? You know, they really think that their supplement works. And then others are just, you know, trying to find what's best for them and they're mistaken, right? So there's this whole entire continuum. But I do think we know that influencers play an important role in the spread of misinformation. So I think they clearly have an obligation to do what they can to. Now, when I say obligation, I don't necessarily mean legal obligation. I mean more than sort of soft moral obligation to not spread content that's going to do real harm, especially in this era of misinformation, right? It's,
right.
You know, maybe there was a time when Oh, you know, I used to hear this when I first started, you know, down this road, you know, the Dr. Oz, early Dr. Oz, early Gwyneth Paltrow. You know, people said, well, you know, what do you care, Tim? You know, people don't really take them seriously. And if they want to spend $1,000 on magical crystals, you know, what harm is that doing? And not that I totally agree with that, but I kind of get that perspective. I don't agree with it, but I kind of understand where it's coming from. First, one of the problems is that just creates this toleration for pseudoscience. But more to the point, I think it's more difficult to make that argument today when we clearly know that the spread of misinformation, even frivolous stuff, as I said earlier, does harm. And I think that kind of heightens the moral obligation to do what you can to try to at least sort of signal in the direction of science-informed content.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's a responsibility for humanity, really, for the good of humanity.
Yeah, I agree with you. I totally agree with you.
So in this era that we're in, you know, this information ecosystem, so chaotic, so overwhelming, social media, there's so much stuff everywhere. How can families recognize and combat misinformation in their everyday lives?
Whew, it is getting more difficult. There's no doubt about it. You know, even if we went back a couple of years, let's say 4 years, i.e. pre-pandemic, it was still tough, but I think it was easier to say, okay, go to trusted sources, you know, look for this, look for that strategy. It is getting more complicated, and then enter AI too, right? I mean, that's just changing everything also. So I think what you, one of the first things you need to do is actually get a sense of what this content is trying to do. Is it playing to your emotions? Is it playing to your ideological leanings? If it's doing that, you should be doubly skeptical. And Kate Starbird, she's a superstar in this field. She's at the University of Washington. And I actually asked her this question. And I thought she'd say, you know, give me this list of strategies, like, you know, critical thinking skills and watch for this kind of representation of a study. And she actually said that. What she actually said was, you know, if it feels like your team just scored a touchdown, that should be a signal to double check the content. Follow what I mean by that? Like, so if it feels like, hey, I always thought that, or oh, I knew they were evil, or of course those people are can't be trusted. If the content is playing to your emotions, that's the signal that you should double check the content. I love that advice, and it's not really intuitive. The second thing I think everyone needs to do, and I am going to roll out that trope of checking your sources and going to trusted sources, but I'm going to put another wrinkle on it. Because of things like AI, because there is so much distrust, go to multiple trusted sources. And if you're hearing the same message, then I think it can be relied on. And it might also take a little bit of patience, especially if it's a big event. Think about, you know, the information that was flowing from the Middle East during that crisis, right? I think it's, you know, a little bit of patience on things is on information is important. The other thing that I'm obsessed about right now is to think about the scientific consensus. And I think this is particularly important for the areas where you guys work in public health. There's a growing body of evidence that tells us that referring to the scientific consensus can be an important tool in fighting misinformation. And that involves also describing exactly what the scientific consensus is, because a lot of people think that's, oh, it's just groupthink. It's about being, you know, overly conservative. No. The scientific consensus, it's always evolving, right? It's always evolving. But there is generally a scientific consensus out there. And that it also respects, you know, a scientific consensus also respects emerging controversial ideas as long as the evidence, you know, is there to support those ideas. Let me give you one example, if I may. I'm going to talk about vaccines. And again, I know everyone's sick of vaccines, but there was a fascinating study from Europe where it found that it asked the general public, what do you think the clinical community and the scientific community thinks of the COVID vaccine? And most people thought, well, I think experts are split. It's kind of 50-50. Some thinks it's, you know, the COVID vaccine is safe and effective, and another 50% are concerned, which is a complete misrepresentation of the reality, right? It's like 99% of experts, of clinicians, of physicians, of researchers think the COVID vaccine is safe and effective in a small minority. And in this study, it was more that the small group that didn't agree with that just were uncertain, right? And if you represent what the scientific consensus actually is to the public, it can have an impact on their behavior. So that is really, really important. So I think we need to do a better job representing the scientific consensus. But, you know, entities like Joe Rogan and other sort of influencers often rely on false balance, right? Elevating these fringe, scientifically unsupported positions to the level of a reasonable alternative to the scientific consensus. And we have to kind of push back against that. That, again, always leaving room for controversial ideas that, you know, will maybe be proven to be true in the future. And we see that, by the way, they've tested this idea of scientific consensus in the nutrition space too, with things like GMOs. I'm sure you guys know this. The biggest difference between the scientific consensus and the public perception is in fact GMOs, right? It's more so than climate change, more so than vaccines. The idea of GMOs being safe is widely accepted, right, by the scientific community, but very few in the public actually believe that or know that. And so that's another good example of the impact can have. And by the way, that's a good example of a belief that can have an adverse impact on those from lower income communities. So there was one study, I'm sure you might be aware of this study, that found that, you know, really emphasizing organic food and non-GMO led those communities to eat less fruits and vegetables, because the thinking was, well, if I can't find non-GMO or organic, there's no point, which is a horrible outcome. It's a good example of, you know, that noise, that wellness noise having an adverse impact.
Yeah, definitely. And contributing to the stigma too, especially with that example with the fruits and vegetables, like that, which, you know, creates a whole slew of other issues as well. And I just really like what you said too about it can be a bit hard to get to the science, right? And so I think that's one of the opportunities that science and the academic community has for knowledge translation, because, you know, journal articles are hard to read, right? They're, a lot of them are hidden behind paywalls. Yeah. Not a ton of it is open access. And sometimes it's honestly just hard to understand too, right? Like, I'm a PhD student and sometimes I reread an article like three times. So I'm like, what are they saying? Right? And so it's hard for the general public to get that information and that evidence. And so there's definitely an opportunity, I think, for the scientific community for a bit more like knowledge translation there, which would hopefully help a bit with some of the misrepresentation that's going on.
I think so. And I think it's when we talk about critical thinking skills, you know, I think this needs to be part of it, right? Yeah. Explaining a little bit, you know, that science is not a list of facts, right? Science is a process. And if you're looking at a study, you know, think about a few things. You know, how big was the study? Was it just a small study? Was it just a case study, which is barely, right? That's barely evidence. Was it a qualitative or quantitative study? These are really basic things that I think most people can, you know, internalize and use to scrutinize a paper. How big was the sample size? Was there a comparison group, or is this just an anecdote? In fact, our own research has shown that anecdotes, testimonials are used so often to push misinformation, especially in social media. I mean, social media is an anecdote machine, right? And, you know, telling kids, you know, young children, young adults, that you just cannot rely on an anecdote. That's, of course, one of the reasons pop culture has such a big impact.
No, that's very true. I feel like that kind of eases into our next question really well. And this is, you know, I full disclosure, I'm asking for advice here with this next question too. But with the rise of conspiracy theories and anti-science movements, how do you approach engaging with individuals who may be deeply entrenched in these beliefs? And are there effective communication strategies for fostering a productive conversation and promoting scientific literacy?
Yeah. So, I mean, this is a tough one. And unfortunately, I think it is getting tougher, beginning talking, you know, referencing back to that comment about ideology and echo chambers. You know, once someone becomes part of a community, it can be very difficult to pull them out, because they almost feel like they're being disloyal or that they're going to lose the community that they have if they don't embrace these beliefs. There was a fascinating study that came out, I'm going to say a year ago, maybe not even. And it sounds like a silly study, but it's not. What they found was that those that are in, and by the way, they controlled for all the obvious variables that you'll think of immediately, those that are in loving relationships are less likely to fall for conspiracies. And again, they controlled for, and it's hard to study this well. So, you know, I think we need to be careful not to overinterpret this data, but I agree with the spirit of their conclusions. What they speculated was that you're often drawn to conspiracy theories because you are looking for a community, right? So you have that need. And once you're there, you may feel like you have a home now. So it can be very difficult. And I think that should invite some empathy, by the way, when dealing with people that have fallen into these, you know, conspiracy theory communities. So I think you need to recognize that, you know, off the top. And then the other thing we need to recognize is the power of those echo chambers. And I'm going to refer to another study. This was a study that was done at Yale University. And I think it's a hilarious study. But what they did, and it was a pretty big N, by the way, they paid Fox News viewers to watch CNN, right? Huh. And the reason they did that, and it's hilarious, right? Because everyone knows what's up. You're paying me to watch, you know, Anderson Cooper. It's not going to work. But it did work. If they had, I think it was 7 hours a week. They paid them to watch 7 hours of CNN. And it worked in the sense that it did have an impact on their perception, their beliefs around particular issues. Uh-huh. Now that, I'm sure they regressed to the Fox News perspective when they went back. But the important thing here is exposing people to different perspectives matters. So how do we respond mm-hmm. to these individuals? We got to recognize why they might be in these communities. We have to recognize the power of the echo chamber that they might be residing in. We have to remember that there may be other forces that are driving them towards these beliefs. Maybe it's economic strife. Maybe they're in a tough position from a mental health perspective. We have to be empathetic for all those things, right? Having said that, then what we want to do is we want to figure out ways that we can introduce new perspectives to them in a non-threatening way. So there's, again, been really interesting research to suggest that we can do that by trying to find voices that are from within that community or adjacent to that community, right? So voices that share many of the individual's values. And, you know, those voices are out there. They're often not easy to find, but they are out there. And research suggests hear from someone from your own community, right? You're more likely to be influenced by that perspective. And we should do that in as respectful way as we can. And by the way, I think that that's also really why it's so important to fight when you're trying to counter misinformation, to invite as many communities, you know, into the tent as possible. So I think that's really important. And of course, patience is important. People don't change their mind overnight. No one ever goes, you know, now that you mention it, Tim, you're right. That never happened. And so, you know, patience, I think, is really, really important. And I'm not a mental health expert, so I'm just talking about, you know, when you're thinking about this, when it's extreme, you should almost think of it like a cult, right? You know, and so you've seen some mental health experts draw on the cult literature here, the cult research. And why I think that's important is what they recommend is often your relationship is more important than trying to debunk this person, right?
Yeah.
So if you get too aggressive, if you're going to lose that relationship, and that relationship is more important than trying to get them to change their mind on this particular topic. So always remember to back away. You know, when the heat gets too hot, you know, you back away a little bit and reengage when you can have a more constructive conversation. I have other suggestions, but those are a few points there, and kind of obvious. You probably could have thought of all those yourself.
No, they're good reminders, because honestly, that especially in the moment, like, goes out the window, right? Like, for example, I love my family, and I won't say which members, but there's some people closest to me who, you know, I got my master's in nutrition, and I think I know some things. You know, I think even with getting a master's degree, I realized how much I don't know and how much there's still out there for me to learn. But with the knowledge that I do know, you know, I can come in and be like, actually, this is what the research says. And, you know, going through the scientific process and seeing how much it takes to run a research study and like do all these things, it's like, no, like, this is from repetition, you know, not from article on Google or like from a social media post. Like,
it's a body of evidence.
Exactly. Exactly. There's a body of evidence. Like in that moment, it's like, just listen to me. But I think your reminder for empathy and for patience and even just like the relationship with that person is so much more important than just hearing, you know, like, you're right, I should change my mind. Like it's so much more than that. And so that was a great reminder, honestly, because, and especially to remember before, especially like holidays, to remember this beforehand when those conversations tend to come up, like that was really helpful.
You know, the other thing I think is so important, which you reminded me of, is intellectual humility, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, you have a graduate degree in this topic, and what you find out is the evidence does evolve. And I, you know, Oh my gosh, we don't really know about this. And you know what? Studying nutrition is hard. Yes. it's hard. It's hard to get definitive answers. And so you should always ask yourself, you know, what have I changed my mind on when the evidence evolved? And I often find that's a good way to engage a conversation. And so actually I have this list of things I've changed my mind on as the evidence evolved. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's some things are big things and some things are little things. But if you don't have that list and if you can't do that, there's probably something wrong with how you're approaching evidence in these kinds of topics, because it should be a badge of honor to change your mind on a topic when the evidence evolves. And one of my favorite examples, we talked about it on the top. I'm a little bit of an exercise fanatic. And I used to kind of, like, I'm embarrassed to say this now, but I used to kind of, I almost say mock, you know, walking or dancing or yoga. That's not real exercise. I know, isn't that terrible? It's terrible. I've totally changed my mind. You know, not just because now I love walking and I totally get it, but you look at the evidence, right? Mm-hmm. The evidence, It just freaking move, you know, find something you love and move. It doesn't have to be, you know, Olympic weightlifting and super intense intervals. Just do whatever the hell you enjoy and get out there and move. That's just one example, right? And I have a long list, you guys, to keep my mind on as the evidence evolves. And that's a good thing. And we should all have that list.
Yeah, definitely. I'm going to start building my list because I agree. That is an awesome thing to be aware of, especially because things do evolve and that's normal. And that's part of this world that we're in. I mean, yes, with nutrition, it's very hard to do nutrition research for numerous reasons, you know, because there are so many factors that do influence our eating beyond just what we're physically putting in our mouths. No, it's so applicable to like every aspect of our lives. So I'm going to get going. That's my goal for the long weekend. I'm going to make a list of things that I've changed my mind about. Now, as we're approaching like the end of our podcast, I'm going to ask you to share some tips with our families here that are listening. So first off, if you could just share some tips on parents, you know, some strategies for them to teach their children critical thinking skills and digital literacy, because we did talk about how the younger generation is increasingly more susceptible to misinformation. And then also just kind of like three take-home tips that you can give families on navigating the infodemic and overcoming all these challenges that we've been talking about with the influx of information that all of us are taking in on a daily basis.
Okay, I'm going to cheat a little bit. How about I mush those two together a little bit? Because there's so many tips you can give with critical thinking skills, right? There's so many elements to it, but let's focus on, you know, reminding kids and really everyone what good evidence looks like. And we've already touched on, I think, one of the big things, right? That an anecdote is not good evidence. It might be an opportunity. It might invite inquiry, but that's not good evidence. You always want, you know, you want to always want to turn to what the body of evidence says on the topic. Also, one study does not a body of evidence make, right? You got to watch that, you know, single study syndrome, right? Even a big study is just one study, especially if it runs counter to a body of evidence, right? So I think those are two, just implementing those two strategies, I think can really make a big difference. Mm-hmm. And the other thing, other tool that I think is so useful, and there's a growing body of evidence to support this, is this idea of just pausing, right? Just taking a break. So I mean that big and small. We've talked over and over again about how chaotic our information environment is. And there is some evidence that is one of the reasons we fall for misinformation. There's just social media fatigue. There's information fatigue. Yeah. So just taking that break, again, both big and small. So the big break is step away from the noise periodically. You know, maybe put your phone down at 8 o'clock every night and don't go back to it. Don't have it in your bedroom. You know, just step away from the noise. And not only is that good for your mental health, and there's research that backs that up, it also, there's some evidence that suggests it's good for your critical thinking, because then when you re-engage, you're fresh. And then in the small sense, just take a beat. Just pause, you know, when you see content. And research by people like Gordon Pennycook at Cornell and David Rand at MIT, they've found that even a short pause and reminding yourself to just think of accuracy, embrace the concept of accuracy, just a short pause when you see content makes you less likely to believe misinformation, less likely to share misinformation, right? Because our information environment is so chaotic. If we can get people just to pause. And I love that recommendation because it's something we can remind ourselves to do. We can remind our family and friends to do that. And it might be scalable. It might be the kind of intervention that's scalable that just might have an impact on slowing the spread and embrace of misinformation.
That's awesome. Thank you for sharing those tips with our listeners. I know I took a lot of notes. Is there anything you're currently working on or looking forward to in the near future that you'd like to share with our audience?
Yeah, I'm working on right now on a new documentary where we've already started filming it. And we're going to be hopefully filming most of the shooting before the end of next month. And we're looking at all of the health myths around this new masculinity push, right? Mm. The Liver King, Joe Rogan.
Yep.
You can imagine the kinds of things that we're tackling. Yeah. And I'm going to, you know, I'm experiencing a lot of them. And I also think this whole masculinity push does real harm to teenagers, you know, to young adults, it's, you know, inappropriate pressure on them, you know, body image issues too. So we're going to explore all of those things. And does this push towards more masculinity do more harm than good? Mm. So I'm really excited about that. And the filming's gone really well already. So I'm quite hopeful. I have a new book coming out and we are continuing to do some really interesting research with my amazing, amazing research team on a range of topics, including microbiome and gut health. We're looking at bogus stem cell therapies. We're looking at how algorithms twist and misrepresent health. So lots of exciting empirical work on the go too.
Yeah, that's amazing to hear about. There's a lot of cool work that you've got coming down the pipeline, and I can't wait for it. I'm very excited for this documentary. I will definitely watch it when it comes out because that sounds fascinating. Thank you so, so much, Timothy.
Thanks for having me on, you guys. Really, really enjoyed the conversation.
Yeah, this conversation about just like misinformation and science and everything has been so fun and insightful. So to our listeners, don't forget to follow Timothy on Instagram and Twitter /X at @CaulfieldTim.
And we hope our listeners can try some of these useful tips that you've shared and that they enjoyed this episode. We'll see you all next time.